author, investigative mythologist, co-host of the popular radio show with Whitley Strieber's Dreamland, William Henry. He's on a mission to reveal the lost codes of myth and symbols. He specializes in ancient myths of beings that come and go via gates to the stars. He has supplied, by the way, some tremendous graphics on coasttocoastam.com. Go take a look. His research encompasses parallel universes, wormholes, spiritual alchemy, and in his latest book and DVD set, Starwalkers and the Dimension of the Blessed, William reveals the ultimate ability that all of us have and one day may use, the secret power to transform our bodies into immortal bodies of pure light and become star walkers. He's back, William Henry. Hello, William. How are you?
Great, George. How are you? Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Me too. You've been busy these days?
Incredibly busy. This is always a great time of year because I'm winding up one project and getting geared for a new one.
I love this time of year. I just absolutely love it. It allows you to sit back and let your mind just think about things. I think more so than at any other time because it's a relaxing period for me, William.
Oh, me too. It's always a time of reflection. I mean, in fact, by the old calendar, this was the month of December was spent in reflection until the time around Christmas when the sun reappears or is reborn. And then we go into a period starting the new year where we start to assemble our seeds and get ourselves aimed forward in a new direction.
William, 6 years from now, 6 years from today, the Mayan calendar date, that date we've been talking about for so long, what do you think's going to happen? What's your take on that?
Well, of course, what is going to happen is already happening. There are so many pieces that are coming together. My particular focus or specialty as concerns 2012 concerns this idea that the Mayans expressed about a serpent rope, which might be an arcane term for a stargate or a wormhole, is going to open from the galactic center. And from out of this, they said, is spews this blessed substance that they called eats and described it as cosmic sap. Well, I had a very fortuitous occurrence. I consulted God or a form of God once, Google, and I typed in I typed in cosmic sap, and out pops an acronym that SAP stands for subatomic particle. Well, as we'll talk, it turns out that the folks at CERN, the Center for European Nuclear Research, have built the world's largest particle accelerator, the world's largest machine, in fact, to search for the God particle, an elusive subatomic particle, exactly like the Mayans said is going to happen in 2012. So here we are with this collection of minds all aimed towards this event, and it's happening.
Yeah, that collider that they've got at CERN, doesn't that go online in less than a year now?
November 2007 is when it's slated to get fired up, and there's all kinds of excitement around this. They're calling it a discovery machine to answer a cosmic challenge. They're calling it literally a time machine. Some are calling it a gate. They literally think they're going to be able to prove the existence of other dimensions.
I sure hope they know what they're doing, William. They could blow up the planet, couldn't they?
They could blow up the universe. I mean, that's one of the possibilities here is that they're saying, wait a minute, we're going to put the entire human race and possibly even the universe on the line for the benefit of a few scientists so that they can promulgate their pseudo-religion here. I mean, that sounds like a harsh criticism, but that is being leveled against this project. But yet, they said the same thing about the Manhattan Project. They said the same thing about other colliders that have been in successful operation for years. So what is different about this one is the power that's involved. It's going to be vastly superior than other colliders, but yet detractors say it might not even be powerful enough. So all I can say is we're on the edge of our seats right now.
Well, theoretical physicists think that they very well will find proof of the existence of other dimensions. And I think if they do this, William, it's going to change everything that we think we know.
Instantly. I mean, we're not talking just about a new era of physics. We're talking about an aurora consurgens, as the alchemists call it, a new dawn, a new beginning. And that's why the stakes are so high here. And one of the things I've been paying attention to is the use of mythological imagery at CERN. I mean, first of all, the thing is a 17-mile-long tunnel. So it's effectively a giant ring.
Now, and is it above ground or is it underground?
It's underground.
It is 17 miles underground.
That's right. And it runs through France and part of Switzerland. And so if we're thinking of this thing as a ring, then we must be thinking of the scientists at CERN as the ring lords. And in the ancient world, when we saw people holding rings, they were described as the ring of cosmic sovereignty. The ring of cosmic sovereignty. And what that meant was that the beings involved possessed incredible universal or cosmic knowledge. And that's what we're grasping here. We're toddlers right now. As Fred Allen Wolf has said, we're still in the ooga booga phase. But when this thing fires up, if we can get a hold, if we can grasp this ring of cosmic sovereignty, suddenly it transforms us into a whole new species.
Why do they call it the God particle when they do this experiment?
Well, because it's going to answer so many questions. It's going to fill in so many gaps. They feel like one of the things it's going to do is it's going to provide the answer of where is all the missing mass in the universe, for example. And it's going to finally give us a unified field theory, they believe. So that kind of answers why they think that they call it the God particle, because it's going to almost in effect tune us into the mind of God.
Now, exactly what are they going to do, William, once they flip the switch? What's going to happen?
Well, they're all of a sudden going to start sending these photons singing around this giant ring, smashing them into one another, and then they've got these detectors that are going to be able to record what's happening. And by the way, I mean, the amount of data this thing's going to start spitting out once it starts recording next year is going to almost instantly, match the total amount of data in the Library of Congress. And in fact, what they've done is created this massive computer grid, a global computer grid that's going to make the internet as it exists today look like a bicycle compared to a Harley Davidson. We're talking about incredible amounts of data coming out, and suddenly this massive global brain gathering together to analyze that data.
But there is that possibility that something could go awry here, right?
Absolutely. In fact, of course, Dan Brown picked up on this, wrote about it in Angels and Demons. And I expect that as we get closer to the event next November, there could possibly be massive public outcry against this project. They'll probably start talking about Frankenstein monster type stuff and science gone wild, because it does have that potential. We're dealing with such incredible power. I mean, they're literally talking about recreating the conditions that existed at the time of the Big Bang.
Let's do a roundtable discussion, William, with you at part of the panel in November of next year. Now, you say it goes online November 7th, so we'll figure it out, but we should do that.
Oh, I would love it. In fact, I'm planning on visiting there this summer. I've got a Holy Grail tour that I'm taking to France in June. And while I'm there, I'm going to dart over to CERN and take the tour and just kind of poke around a little bit and see it for myself, because it is the project on the planet right now. And again, as we were talking, the stakes are so incredibly high, but yet what we need here and what, in fact, physicists are talking about and proposing is that one, are we going to be able to understand the results of this experiment? And two, do we have the necessary backstory, if you will, to be able to communicate what's happening to people? And so they're saying we need to get sages involved, we need to get seers involved, and I'm saying we need to get mythologists involved, because this is a universal story that we're enacting right now, and we're all part of it.
Now, when in June are you going to go? Because I get a vacation in June.
Well, we're leaving on June the 10th, and we're going to do Paris. We're going to do southern France, Rennes-le-Château. We'd love to have you, George.
Yeah, let me check. I'll check the schedule. I know things free up a little bit toward the end of June into July, but we'll check, because I know Arbitron, that does ratings, they're changing the summer period, and there may be no days off at all for ratings. And if that's the case and I have a vacation, then it doesn't matter. So it might work out. I've never been to France or Paris.
You would love it. I mean, you get Paris, you get all the incredible sites there, the Louvre, you get the history. Then you go down to southern France and you walk the land of the Cathars and Rennes-le-Château. It's a beautiful trip.
Those French really dislike us. They seem to have forgotten World War II and what we did for them, huh?
Well, the politicians always have to have their gigs going, and then what you find out when you actually go to these places is that the people are very open-hearted and love us, but it's the politicians that have to you know, do their deal.
You know, if I had a friend who saved my life, no matter what he did in his life, I'd always be his friend. I'd guide him. I'd give him advice. But I never turned my back on them. I couldn't. I think they've done that to us. You know, they may have been right about some of the things that have happened over the last several years, but I don't like the way they turn their backs on us.
Yeah, we're in a really funny global situation, aren't we? I mean, things change so quickly, and our former friends become enemies suddenly. But that also holds the hope that our present-day enemies will also become our friends. And that, to me, is also one of the promise of the Large Hadron Collider and the project there at CERN, is that, you know, most traditional believers, including Jews, Christians, and Muslims, assume that this is the only possible universe created by God. What if there are others? What if we're on the verge of discovering that this isn't all there is? That changes things dramatically, and suddenly the war on terror is stupid. It serves no purpose, because it doesn't go towards the ascension, the evolution of our species. And that's what I think we're all trying to get aim for here in 2012, is this idea that we can transform our present difficulties. We can make lemonade out of the lemons we've got going on right now, and that's what we must focus our energy and emotion on.
You know, war other than defense is stupid. And I would hope one day that this planet would evolve to the point where people are caring about other people, taking care of them rather than killing them.
Yeah, and we have to. And again, CERN, they use the term, one of their experiments is called Atlas. Well, Atlas is the name of a Greek god who's portrayed holding the world on his shoulders. But Atlas was also the name of the priest king of Atlantis for whom that civilization was named. And Edgar Cayce and folks have said, hey, the Atlantean civilization misused a power source. They used it for weapon systems.
And it came back and got them, didn't it?
And it came back and got them. And so here we have this revolutionary technology put right before our eyes. We're calling it Atlas, and I think it's a trigger to make us remember, hey, this is tremendous power we have in our hands, and we've got to use it wisely this time.
William, tell us about your definition of what a starwalker is.
A starwalker, well, this is a term that I got from ancient Egypt. There's a drawing on the tomb of Tutankhamun that's presently in the Cairo Museum. And on this tomb, we see Osiris, who is the Egyptian god of resurrection, the Lord of eternity, the Lord of the field of the blessed. And beside him is a five-pointed star. Now, the Egyptian word Saba means star, but it also means door. And beside that star is the determinative for walking. And what we're told is that this meant that Osiris was passing through a star door, and it reflects his soul's passage through these doors into a place they called the dimension of the blessed. So a star walker is a person who ascended bodily into the heavens and now walks the stars for eternity.
And you say we all have the potential to do this?
Absolutely, and it's not just me. This record of humans who have transformed themselves into star walkers actually is found throughout the Bible as well. Enoch, Elijah, possibly Moses, most definitely Jesus, effected this transformation of themselves into a being of light and became a star walker.
And do they ever come back into their physical body?
They don't come back to their physical body as much as they can make appearances. Think of Jesus after the resurrection. He returned, reappeared to the disciples. Elijah
In form. He came back in form, didn't
exactly.
he?
Exactly. But he said to Mary Magdalene, don't touch me. Perhaps because he's in a different form, maybe a light body form as it's described. And so what we find is that the figures who have affected this transformation, which we can all do, are able to toggle between this realm and a realm that's described as the field or the dimension of the blessed.
What did he say? Because you bring it up. He did say, don't touch me, but he elaborated a little further. He said something like,
I have not yet gone to the Father.
Yeah, exactly. Which, if you broke that down in a metaphysical sense, what do you think that meant?
Well, what I think it meant is that he's still in an intermediate phase. In the images, the graphics that are on the co-site right now, in particular number 2, the gate to the dimension of the blessed, very often these figures are portrayed in a gateway. They are in an intermediate realm between this dimension and another dimension. And they're in a form, an intermediate phase. They are literally phase shifting out of this material realm into more of an ethereal realm. And in fact, this was the whole purpose of the ancient mystery schools. And Jesus even said in the Pistis Sophia not to stop seeking. Don't do anything except find the purifying mysteries, which will purify us and make us into a refined light, so that we can go on height and inherit the light of my kingdom. What he's saying is, find these mysteries that unlock this latent capability in our DNA so that we can become a star walker.
Depictions of star walkers showing, of course, the modern science describing as wormholes. Tell me about that tie-in.
Well, that's one of the hallmarks or trademarks of my research, if you will. I started noticing that, in particular, in ancient Egypt, when you would see the gods on their ships sailing into eternity, sailing into the dimension of the blessed, they're riding aboard craft that the depictions of perfectly match the way modern science portrays a wormhole. And it became perfectly clear to me that what they are describing here is likely the primordial sacred science that these beings, these star walkers, possessed. How to open gateways and travel through the wormholes that science says permeates the known universe.
And do you think they do this with physical craft, or they do it, again, with breaking down into this beam?
I think they probably do it by dissolving themselves, as one of the words that is used, into pure energy. In fact, this became a really important piece of research that has led me forward now. I was at a UFO conference, and I had a really nice couple, the coast-to-coast listeners, and they came up to me, and they said, hey, we really love the research that you're doing into the stargates and wormholes. And I said, wow, well, thanks. And they said, no, listen, we have PhDs from the Harvard Divinity School. We've lived in Tibet. We know all of the lamas that have come over here to the West. We've lived in India, and we've been studying this whole esoteric secret Tibetan tradition where these lamas can dissolve themselves into pure energy. And they said, what you have done is answered possibly the question of what happens after they dissolve themselves into light. They enter a wormhole.
Stay with us. William Henry, our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. His website, WilliamHenry.net. William, let's talk a little bit about why you call this the dimension of the blessed. How did that phrase come about?
Well, for a long while, I had been collecting various myths and stories about, especially the Egyptian stories about the field of the blessed. And it was actually our good friend and colleague, Sir Lawrence Gardner, who came along in his book, Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark, and said that the field of the blessed was also known as the dimension of the blessed. And Lawrence made an amazing case that the ancient Egyptian mystic pharaohs manufactured a substance called mufkit or manna that enabled them to communicate with this dimension and actually enter into it.
Now, is this like the powdered white gold?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's what I thought. We haven't talked about that in a long time. Are people still using that?
I think they are, and I've really kind of discouraged people from that, just because we're not reproducing the ancient Muffkit, in my opinion. And so, you know, experiment if you like, but I think we need to do more looking into that matter.
Let's talk a little bit about these graphics that you supplied us on the coasttocoastam.com website, if you can.
Mm-hmm.
Elaborate a little bit more on them, if you would, William.
Yeah, in number one, what I call the wormhole ships, we see the clear comparison between the way modern science portrays a wormhole or a stargate and the way the ancient Egyptians portrayed the ships that their gods would sail upon into eternity. They're sailing across the waters of the Nile, which is the heavenly Nile, also known as the Milky Way. And what we see on the bottom of that page is Osiris star walking on his wormhole boat. Now, it's important to note that this wormhole boat is referred to as, in the Egyptian term, a celestial ferry. In other words, this was a means of conveyance. This was the ship that this god, Osiris and others, would sail upon into eternity. Now, here's something really interesting, George. And when they're crossing the waters of the heavenly Nile, the Milky Way, on this ferry boat, they're in a vehicle for crossing the stars.
Mm-hmm.
The terms that I'm using here, ferry boat, and method of crossing, were also applied by the Sumerians to Nibiru.
That's interesting.
The planet, the supposed planet of the Anunnaki. And, of course, I've gone on record and saying, well, wait a minute. If all this adds up right, it suggests that Nibiru may not be a planet after all. The Anunnaki are entering this realm through a stargate or a wormhole. And lo and behold, here come the Egyptian, the pyramid texts, which are loaded with references to crossing the expanse of the heavenly waters, and describe in particular the process of transformation that's undergone by these initiates on his journey to the stars. And as the pyramid texts tell us, which cover some of the tombs in ancient Egypt, they tell us that as the initiate achieves illumination of the divine world, the dimension of the blessed, that he then boards this ferry, this celestial boat that resembles a wormhole, and sails into eternity upon it.
What does Nibiru mean, William? Do you know?
Well, when you go to the Chicago Assyrian Dictionary, which is considered to be the benchmark for the Sumerian language, the dictionaries left by the Sumerians, they tell us that the word Nibiru has a variety of meanings. All of them are related to the idea of crossing, or being some form of a crossing marker, or especially a crossing point. And when you see Nibiru in these dictionaries, it's preceded by a D, which is the Sumerian superscript for deity, and also by Mul, which is the cuneiform sign for star. And so from this, we deduce that Nibiru is a star, a gate, a crossing point, and a deity.
How did all this ancient knowledge, how did it all come about?
Well, when you dig on down to the very bedrock of some of these creation mythologies, especially in Egypt and Sumeria, you're talking about instructors that came from the stars, especially Sirius. And these instructors brought this knowledge along with the symbol system that we're looking at here, including these wormhole symbols, to us and left them for us to rediscover at a later time.
Are we ready for it now?
Well, we're going to get a shot at it. We're stepping up to the plate here, and we're going to find out how ready we are. And that's why it's so important for everybody to recognize that we're all on this boat together. And in fact, when they talk about these creation mythologies, the field of reeds is another name for this field of the blessed, or the dimension of the blessed. And one of the key images that they use is the bundle of reeds, the bundle of sticks. The idea being that a single reed does not have the strength that a bundle of reeds has.
And so you're very meticulous when it comes to symbols, aren't you?
Well, they're the language of the gods.
Yeah.
It's the language of the enlightened beings. And if we can tap into the symbols, I believe they activate knowledge within us. I think a lot of this knowledge is already hardwired into our DNA. What we need is the software, the symbols that will enable it to be activated.
You remind me of a younger version of Jordan Maxwell.
Godfather.
When you talk about symbols and things like that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Jordan, of course, is a symbol master, and I always like the story. Jordan, where were you when JFK was assassinated? Oh, I was on my way to give a talk about the Illuminati.
how fascinating that was. Parallel dimensions, stargates, very important. You've done a lot of work in this arena. As a matter of fact, a lot of your work has to do with this. What's going on these days scientifically? I mean, they talk about a major black hole in the center of the Milky Way. They witnessed last week a star apparently that got sucked in by a dark one of those black holes. What's happening in the universe, William?
Well, I'm tracking two major, what I call, galaxy-sized trends. One is we're learning the basic secrets of the universe. We're talking basic secrets from a galactic perspective. We're learning that we're citizens of the galaxy. We're learning what our bodies are made of, stardust. We're learning that there's a black hole at the center of our galaxy, that is possibly a gateway to other dimensions. At the same time that we're accumulating that whole body of knowledge, a literal transformation of the human body is underway as well. We're transforming ourselves from offline organic beings to online semi-digital other dimensional beings. And there's no coincidence that those two trends are coming together. I think they are balled up in this incredible shift that is underway on the planet right now, away from suffering and terror to ascension and raising ourselves into a cosmic species.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. No, finished.
Well, I was just going to say that as Dr. Michio Kaku and others have alerted us, this is the most dangerous time for a species. This is when we will grab the ring of cosmic sovereignty or we won't. And if we don't,
we won't.
We start all over again.
We can always drop the ball on this, can't we?
Well, we can swing and miss.
When you were doing some of your work with these portholes, how did you research it? I mean, where did you go to find out about other dimensions? Or was it right out there, we just didn't interpret it the right way?
George, it's like coming on a gold mine where the nuggets are right at the front door and there's a sign that says, dig here.
Yeah.
Okay?
Just pick them up.
Just pick them up. I mean, it's all over the place, and I'm thrilled that it's being so well received. In fact, I'm going to Rome, Italy. I've been invited to give a talk in Rome, Italy in March, the 1st of March, for a Stargate 2012 conference. That's a title of one of my lecture presentations. And this group of European researchers have grabbed hold of the idea, and they're having a conference in March, and I'm kind of the honorary speaker there. So I'm starting to see that this whole idea of our body and our lives as needing to be spent in preparation for life in another dimension is really catching on. And what we're seeing is that this idea of the portals and gateways of the ancients is becoming more and more important to modern consciousness, because that's more and more what our lives are going to be about, is learning the secrets of these gates and actually utilizing them.
What do you think the ancients used these portals for?
Well, transportation, for certain. They also were acutely aware of the influence of cosmic rays and and especially focusing on supernovas and the use of stellar energy to amp up their bodies, to keep them, to bathe them in these high frequency vibrations that enable them to access fuller consciousness. And that's one of the things that we've been deprived of, especially these past 1,600 years or so. We literally have been in a dark age. But now the light is returning. The lights are coming on. And so we look at this symbolism when we're starting to understand exactly what it is. Oh, those are wormholes they're riding upon. Oh, they spent their lives in preparation for entering those gates by preparing themselves, by purifying themselves and perfecting themselves and understanding that from the soul's perspective, our body is a ladder or stairway to heaven. This is kind of new for a lot of us. And once we get a hold of this, we start to treat our bodies a lot more kindly. And we start to focus our energy and emotion on a higher purpose for our life, which is the beginning point to becoming a star walker.
Why does it seem that in Asia specifically, in areas like Tibet, that they are more spiritual than we are over here?
Well, that's a perception, I think. They're the same as you and I.
Are they?
Yeah, they crack up at the same jokes. They like a lot of the same things that we do. They just focus themselves on more esoteric matters, I think. And they have a longer tradition. And one of the key differences here, and this is a big part of the premise in Star Walkers and the Dimension of the Blessed, is that their culture supports the idea of achieving enlightenment. Ours does not. You're a wacko if you're on the path to enlightenment. Our culture says you can't do that. You must have a really blown out ego. Who the hell do you think you are thinking you can achieve enlightenment? Let's just go back to our regular cultural programming of suffering and misery. Who are you to think you can talk about ascension and resurrection? And those are the real choices here. And so what is happening with a lot of this Stargate business, especially as we get closer to 2012, is that our culture more and more is going to shift into this idea that supports an individual's quest for awakening or enlightenment.
Now, when you say support his individual request, you mean it's going to be like one-on-one?
No, what I mean is that it's going to be okay for people to openly say, hey, I'm on the path to enlightenment, okay, without our culture.
Without ridicule?
Without ridicule, without people saying, disparaging you, saying, oh, you know, that's crazy, that's wacky, that's flaky.
Go ahead.
And what's going to happen is that there are going to be spiritual and biological effects that are going to result from this. What they teach us in the mystery schools is that there is literally a bioinformational field that connects us to the dimension of the blessed. And by obsessively studying it, making this the focus of our life, as Jesus said in the Pistis Sophia, don't do anything except find these purifying mysteries that make you into a refined light. That search literally has the potential to change our biology. And so if people possess a cosmology and a cultural belief that allows and supports crossing between the worlds, they can then access hidden biospiritual powers latent within our DNA.
What does this have to do with, I guess, the ability to go through portals and participate in witnessing end times? Where's the tie-in?
Well, the tie-in is that in the New Testament, especially in the book of Mark, Jesus demonstrated his transformation into a being of light. He took the disciples up to the mountain and affected this transformation while Moses and Elijah accompanied him.
This was after he was killed?
This is before.
Before,
yeah,
okay.
This is, and so what happens is that as he shows this incredible demonstration of his transformation into his body of light, literally, and then on the way down the mountain, he tells the disciples, hey, I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't mention this, keep this quiet until his return. And this is the end time connection. Many people believe that, of course, there is going to be a second coming. This has been prophesied, and it's thought to occur at a so-called end time. And so it suggests to me, it makes sense to me that the revelation of these esoteric secrets of the what's called the rainbow body or the light body would occur at these end times when Christians propose that not only is Jesus going to return, but that all of us, the believers, will be raptured into heaven in bodily form. This another term for rapture, I believe, is becoming a star walker.
Would you go?
Absolutely. I mean, I am committed to this path. This is going to be the focus of my research. You'll probably hear me planning a Tibet trip sometime, and I've got a stack of some incredibly scholarly works that have been recommended to me by that couple I mentioned a moment ago.
Right.
And so that's where I'm aimed right now, is to really look into this in more detail, because it is the ultimate human transformation. It is, according to the ancient mystery schools, what this life is supposed to be all about.
Did the Egyptians get involved in this?
Absolutely. That was one of the big surprises, George, is that here I am getting into this Tibetan research, and I'm seeing these amazing paintings of figures in this who have affected this great perfection or transformation into their light body. And lo and behold, those paintings, the colors, the shapes, the symbols match the way the Egyptians portrayed Osiris as he had transformed into a star walker.
Did they show ships as well?
The Tibetans didn't show the ships as much as they showed the open gate, open portals, with their enlightened beings sitting in these portals or in these gateways. And so it's simply a different view, whereas the Egyptians tended to show the ships in profile, the Tibetans tended to show it from the face on, as if you're looking into it as opposed to looking at it from the side. Imagine looking at a car and you're looking at the windshield and the grill. That's kind of the Tibetan view, and you have the passenger sitting in the seat. Well, the Egyptians tended to show the vehicle, the craft, from the side. And so you would see the side view. You'd see the wheels, you'd see the basic shape, and you'd see the passenger inside. And so it's just it's the same thing, but from a slightly different perspective.
I've always been curious at how mortals, you and me, can tap into this and, you know, to possibly go through these portals. Because I think if you do, you could use it for some incredible things, couldn't you?
Well, absolutely. But what is most important to me is this whole mystery school teaching that accompanies these portals. Every time I find them, I also find these references to a transformation, to an empowerment, if you will, of the human soul. They were using tones, they were using lights, they were using plants to affect this transformation, but especially they were awakening the power of the heart.
You're right on tonight, William. We'll be back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. What a fast hour. William, I believe everything in this universe has order, there's purpose. What do you think portals or wormholes, their main purpose is? I mean, why were they part of this?
Well, when you come upon the idea of portals or gateways, you're always thinking in terms of connection. And that is, of course, their bottom line purpose is to connect us to other places, to other beings. And ultimately, we're all part of a network, a fabric of the cosmos, as it's described. In fact, the ancient Egyptians talked all about the goddess as the great weaver and how the strings of the universe join us all together. So we're really talking about connection.
And is that a very normal part of existence that, you know, they're supposed to be there to maybe ease the way or, you know, as you say, connect?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's the theme of, I mentioned Michio Kaku earlier, and certainly Carl Sagan picked up on this theme in his movie Contact as well, and the idea that once we reveal, once these secrets are revealed to us through our own effort, then this becomes a sort of a graduation for us into away from being an earthbound species into being more of a cosmic species.
And I've got to tell you, one of my favorite movies, Contact, it had it all, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a literal, it's like a mystery school book. I mean, it's astonishing what was in that movie. And in fact, I had started to write an appendix for Star Walkers in which I compared Jedi Foster's character to Moses. Because, in fact, Sagan left just all these references to Moses on Sinai and the burning bush, and the equation of the burning bush with the satellite dish was made in contact, and, of course, the idea of Moses parting the Red Sea is wildly controversial. He actually parted the Sea of Reeds, or the Reed Sea, the Reed Sea being a reference the Egyptians made to the field of the blessed or the dimension of the blessed. And I make the case in my book that the parting of the Red Sea is an allegory for the opening of a portal or a gateway into another dimension. And so, as I said, I started to go on this down this road of making a comparison between Moses' experience on Sinai and parting the Red Sea with the experience of Jodie Foster's character in Contact, again, because Carl Sagan kept suggesting it over and over again.
You know, I thought of you just yesterday when I was walking past a movie rental shop, and they had the posters up now for the Da Vinci Code.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole arena has fascinated you as well. You know, you've been to Rennes Le Chateau.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe the Ark of the Covenant's buried under there?
No, I don't necessarily connect the Ark of the Covenant with Rennes Le Chateau. Rennes Le Chateau is, I think, another gateway. In fact, after that priest, Baron J. Saunier, refurbished his church, the Church of Mary Magdalene there at Rennes Le Chateau, he put above the entrance to the church the inscription, "Terrible is this place. This is none other than the gate to God, and this is the gate to heaven." Well, that's exactly what Jacob proclaimed after he had scaled the ladder to heaven and returned to earth after his dream state. He awakened and said, "This is an awesome and profound place. This is the gate to God and the gate to heaven." So I always associate Rennes Le Chateau with those mysteries as opposed to the Ark of the Covenant, although the Ark is certainly thought to be part of the treasure of King Solomon's temple, and that is one of the possibilities for what is at Rennes Le Chateau. So,
what's it like being an investigative mythologist, William?
I love it. I mean, the word that comes to mind is freedom. I'm free to explore all of these various traditions without feeling encumbered. In fact, people, what they enjoy about my work is that I'm able to weave together seemingly unrelated concepts and different traditions, and it's because I'm not locked into one tradition. I'm not sitting in an ivory tower having to support all those who came before me. I question all who came before me and offer new questions to those who come after me.
If you haven't seen William Henry at a conference, he's the guy where all the women in the conference flock to. You'll find him in the middle there, and they're all over the place. Have you had that? I call it the karma, I guess. Have you had that karma since you were a young kid?
Are you saying I'm like a chick magnet or something? And that kind of karma?
Well, yeah,
or just being a nice guy? I've always been a nice guy.
Well, you give off a certain vibe, William.
Oh.
You give off an energy that people who read energy, like I do, can feel that.
Uh-huh.
And you just watch other people. Lingering, watching you, and it's kind of fascinating to watch. But I'm convinced that people have it all their lives. So I think you had it when you were a kid.
Maybe. I've just kind of, I guess, been oblivious, really.
Really?
Yeah.
How come?
I don't know. I mean, it's just, I don't know what to say, you know?
You're blushing.
Yeah, I am. I'm sorry.
Well, the work you've done has been very important, and you, along with Sir Lawrence Gardner, cover areas that not a lot of people jump into. How do you get your topics? How do you get your subject matter?
Usually, like if I'm writing a book, about half to three-quarters of the way through, the next subject will suggest itself. And then, of course, what you have to do is learn to finish the book you're writing and start the next one with the new material. And so when you're constantly searching, as I am, there's always something new. And as I mentioned earlier, this time it was the appearance of this couple with this amazing background who have provided me with some astonishing research leads. And so now I'm following those, and who knows where that's going to lead. I can't wait to find out.
Do you physically have to go to these locations, or can you do most of it at home, internet, and then you just write that way?
No, you really have to go, George, because it's been my experience time and time again. I've spent years studying a particular image. Let's say in Egypt, in all of my books, I've written about this device called the Pillar of Osiris that the Egyptians portrayed in their temples, and it had all these incredible capabilities, including holding the soul of the Savior Osiris and being able to open portals or gateways. Well, it's only when I actually went to Abydos in Egypt and saw the original depictions, and saw, more importantly, all of the depictions that are not in the books, that it became crystal clear as to the function of this device. And so now I'm on a quest to, when I go to Rome, I'm going to go to the Vatican Museum. There's an amazing depiction of Jesus with a magic wand in his hand, raising Lazarus from the dead that is there. I want to see that in person.
What do you think the wand was?
I think
it's like a laser or something?
No, well, you're close. I think it was, Jesus was a light worker. I think he knew the secrets of light. I think he's an Albert Einstein rolled up with the Dalai Lama, something like that. Incredibly advanced being, of course. And when they portray him with that rod or wand in hand, I'm very comfortable in saying that it's actually a ray of light that he's using to raise Lazarus from the dead. And so
Some energy form, I guess, right?
Yeah, yes. And so I'm itching to get into the Vatican Museum to actually see that personally. See what do they have along with it? How are they portraying it? What are they displaying beside it? Because all of that is very important in many cases.
Do you have connections with the Vatican?
No. So this would be all new territory for me.
Okay, because I was wondering if anybody from the Vatican had ever confided in you about extraterrestrial life or anything like that.
No, nothing like that. But as you well know, you never know who's listening to Coast to Coast. It's a surprise that the people that listen. It's incredible.
Keeps growing too, William.
Pardon me?
It keeps growing and growing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's all coming our way, George. I mean, yeah, a lot of the stuff I write about is cutting edge. It's out there to some people, but it's so far out. It's in. And what more and more people are going to discover is that we are, in fact, really in.
Last Monday, not this week, last Monday, I did two pilots for the Sci-Fi Cable Network. One show was built around Whitley, who did just an incredible job.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he is so good on his feet. He's so good in front of a group. But he was compelling. And it must be fun working with him, huh?
Ann and Whitley Strieber are like parents to me. They kind of adopted me about 10 years ago when I published my first book, and it's just been absolutely amazing. I mean, I can only describe them as being like spiritual godparents to me. I mean, they're so supportive of what I do.
I think they'd rather be called brother and sister to you.
Well, they're incredible teachers, and Whitley, I mean, I just have the utmost admiration and respect for him, and I'm just honored that he's let me be a co-host of Dreamland. It's been a tremendous opportunity to talk to a lot of these authors out here and to shed light on people that might not otherwise get the light shown on them. I just love doing that.
Well, it opens you up, doesn't it? The more people that you talk to or interview, I know it does for me, that it has enlightened me to such a point now where I could never go back and be what I used to be, William.
Yeah, your energy just changes. I mean, just because of the very often the high spirituality or the high intellect that the guests have, and it's really wonderful. And again, because I travel so much, I lecture a couple of times a month. I'm always interacting with the Coast audience, and that's a real thrill too, to actually meet the listeners and listen to what they're interested in, what they want to know, what they like, what they don't like. It's really a tremendous sense of community and family that we're all a part of here.
You're absolutely right. I was with a group of Coast listeners in San Diego on Saturday, and you really get a better perspective when you're there looking at people. They're coming up to you, you know, shaking hands. They're talking about the program. It's very helpful. I mean, it's like a live research project.
Yeah, it is. And it also validates, and it just lets everybody know, hey, we're all here for each other, and we all have the same goal.
You seem to have a positive outlook about the subject matter at hand, the subjects that you cover. But do you ever get doom and gloomish about it or down on it because you've stumbled across something?
Well, yeah, and that happened recently. When I finished Starwalkers, I had connected with this information I mentioned a moment ago about this very, very secret, incredibly closely guarded idea that these llamas could dissolve themselves into pure energy. I mean, what they describe is these llamas will go into a hut, for example.
Like the Dalai Lamas you're talking
yes.
about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And
As opposed to the animal.
Yeah, I always get it confused, too. So, yeah. Thanks for clarifying that. I had a friend who said she was taking care of a llama once, and I kept thinking she was taking care of an animal. It turns
you
out,
would.
No.
I mean, when you first hear it, you think, why are these llamas being so spiritual? They spit at people. How
we're,
could this
we're,
be?
We're innocent as babes, you know. We just take it literally.
Yeah.
What happened is that I learned that these llamas will go into these huts, and 49 days later, their families will open the hut, and there's nothing left of their body but hair and fingernails. They've dissolved themselves into pure energy.
What do you mean, nothing left?
There's nothing
left. They're gone?
They're gone. Exactly. This is called what they call the rainbow body, the great perfection. It's, again, highly secretive, very closely guarded secrets about how this is done. It's an oral tradition that's passed from master to student. And even in modern times, there's been witnesses who have seen this happen. And so I learn about this, and I'm thinking, come on, I'll never be able to do that. What's the point of my life? And so I'm getting kind of discouraged here. And then I said, well, wait a minute. What I've learned is that the Tibetans actually prophesied that they would be persecuted and that this kind of information, these closely guarded secrets, would then reappear in the West. And it's not to say that it would be common knowledge necessarily, but it is definitely coming this way. And so I just decided, well, I can either get down about it or I can get fired up. I can go hit the books. I can get the boots on the ground and start really seeking out these secrets, and that's what I've decided to do.
Do you think the pyramids are portals inside the pyramids?
We don't know all of what's inside the pyramid. You know, Dr. Zahi Hawass was here in Nashville back in June, and he promised that he was going to open a missing tomb, a lost tomb of Khufu, a secret tomb of Khufu in the Great Pyramid before the end of 2006. So he's a little behind schedule. He is making progress. He's got things in place, so it's probably going to be early 07. But we really don't know all of what's inside the Great Pyramid. So it is within the realm of possibility. I always go back to the Egyptian descriptions of the Great Pyramid. They describe it as a glorious light. And it took on the persona of a ladder or a stairway to heaven. And so when you add all of that together, it suggests that, yeah, the Great Pyramid could be some kind of a portal or a gateway.
Well, didn't they have an incredible cap of gold on the top of the pyramids?
Well, nobody knows for sure, but again, Zahi Hawass for the millennium had proposed a golden capstone for the pyramid. In fact, I have a drawing, a diagram that he made of the Egyptian symbol for light, the heron bird, etched upon this golden capstone. And he had planned to put that on top of the pyramid at the millennium, but the world press supposedly put too much pressure on saying it was too Masonic, and he never did that. And in fact, when he was here, I asked him, I said, hey, what'd you do with the golden capstone you were having made to put on the pyramid at the millennium? And he got all puffed up and said, oh, yes, that was my project. I was going to put that on the pyramid, but the world press wouldn't let me do it. So it's still a mystery what happened to that thing.
I have always believed that the Egyptians have already stumbled across the Hall of Records that Edgar Casey said was at the foot of the Sphinx. I just think that somewhere along the line they found it, they've got the material, they've got whatever was in there, and they haven't said anything about it. What do you think?
Well, yeah, my intuition would go along with that. I mean, they keep quoting that 70% of the Egyptian antiquities are still beneath the sand. And then you hear all these nasty rumors about black marketing of these antiquities, possibly even what was there. Nobody knows for sure, but I can only hope that one day soon we will know.
Well, I hope so, too. There's just so much to be learned from that old region of the world. What fascinates me is how the message gets handed down. You know, like the story of the Anunnaki, the story of fallen angels. Have you ever investigated that in terms of how these myths become reality?
Well, yeah. I mean, I spend a lot of time and have spent a lot of time researching the Anunnaki, and I'm a subscriber to that whole idea of the cargo cult, which is that these ancient beings left us a technology, even a spiritual technology, way beyond our comprehension in the ancient world, and they left them as sort of time capsules for us. And what happened in the intermittent years is that whole cultures and religions and societies developed based upon worship of these objects without really knowing exactly what they were.
Well, stay with us. We'll be back in a moment with William Henry. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. William, what's your favorite subject that you've covered over the years? Do you have one topic that you like the best?
Well, the whole Stargate business is the centerpiece, and I just love all of these stories of beings who are coming and going from this planet or plane to other places through portals and gates. It's the story, and it's a subject of endless fascination for me.
It seems to me that's probably the only way you can travel in the universe. You've got to be able to do that, or it's impossible.
Yeah, and you know, we mentioned Sagan earlier. That was his whole dilemma when he wrote Contact is, okay, I don't necessarily think UFOs are the way they travel in space, so how am I going to get my extraterrestrial civilization here so that my novel on First Contact can work? And this is when they came up with the idea of traversable wormholes and the possibility that these beings can simply dial or tune themselves from one place in the universe to another.
Trav from Kansas wants to know, how do we become pure energy, like Tibetan monks, for example?
Well, having not actually affected the transformation myself, I can only describe what I've found out about it. And always it seems the first step towards an evolved consciousness is the understanding that every soul on this planet is here to learn to love. And, you know, while this might sound like kind of stoned hippie talk or something, it's really not. Every tradition says that same thing, that the first step is to understand that we're here to learn to love. And to be evolved means to love and to love fully and to be love. That's what Jesus taught anyway. And so that's the very first place to start, is to recognize, why am I here? Well, I'm here because I need to learn to love, and I need to learn to love fully and to just simply be love. And for some of us, success is going to be simply conveying a sense of love. We all probably have a favorite aunt or know a person that just simply conveys love and that sense of pure-heartedness. And so we can start there. And from the next step from there would be to, I would suggest, begin working with our dreams to try to begin experiencing awakened dreams and to see your light body in your dreams. As John Lennon said, listen to the sound of your dreams. Begin to awaken your other senses in your dreams. And you wrote about some of this in Worker of the Light, George,
yep,
too.
Yeah, sure did. In the subtitle of your book, Starwalkers, you talk about interdimensional beings, basically. What are they?
They are light beings. And this is a term that I derived from Dr. Eve Raymond. She was an Egyptologist. She wrote a very rare but profound book in the 1960s about the Temple of Horus at Edfu and the mythical origin of the Egyptian temples. And etched upon the walls of the Temple of Horus at Edfu, they describe the creation of Egyptian civilization by beings of light who came from elsewhere and created human civilization and crafted the human body. So to answer your question, that these interdimensional beings appear to be beings of light. There's a really interesting researcher, Dr. Jose Arguelles, has looked into this as well, especially from the Mayan perspective. And what he concluded is that these beings are able to transmit themselves from star to star as information. It's sort of like the idea of the Star Trek transporter.
Mm-hmm.
Where they can beam themselves from place to place and reconstitute their bodies or create new bodies once they arrive at a place.
And it is fascinating. Alex wants to know, do you believe that all life in the universe will reach enlightenment by 2012? Interesting question.
I'm not sure about all life in the universe. I certainly think that our planet, the 6.5-7 billion souls on this planet that will be here in 2012 will certainly have that opportunity. And what that is going to mean is I think of us as a collection of seeds. In fact, the alchemists talk about our souls as a seed atom, as a core of spirituality. They describe it in these terms as a spark of divinity. I think it's a time when that spark is going to be fanned by some incredible flames coming from the universe, by some incredible winds coming from the universe, and we can see suddenly this blossoming of the human species.
Phil from New Hampshire wants to know, if there are light beings, are there dark beings? That's interesting.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, yin yang.
Yeah, yin yang. I don't quite know how to answer that. Yes, of course there are. I mean, in this sense, I suppose what he's asking, are there negative beings? Because
forces,
we're thinking,
right, on the dark side.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they seem to literally prey on us. In fact, I've been studying these past several years the Nag Hammadi library that describes beings called archons or rulers who match what we think of as the grays. And in, for example, one of the apocryphal texts, they describe there's a conversation that Jesus is having with one of the disciples, and he describes the archons as toll collectors who seek to take by force our divine spark, our soul spark, because they recognize that is the core within us, is this divine spark. And so, yes, absolutely, there are negative entities out there that act as toll collectors and seek to steal from us our inherent divinity.
Well, they seem to be, leeches, I guess, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the, going back to William Bramley wrote about this. John Lash has talked about this recently, that all throughout history you find evidence of these archons or rulers who seem to be behind the scenes of religious and political authorities pulling the strings.
William, let's talk a little bit on where people can get a hold of this new book, Starwalkers, if you would tell us what the best opportunities are.
Yes, they can come to williamhenry.net and order it there. I also have an order line, which is area code 615-292-7863. So that's, again, 615-292-7863. They can call the order line or go to williamhenry.net and order it right online.
Sounds like you're in Nashville, huh?
Yes. Music City, USA.
Still getting those hits on the website? I remember the first time you were on the program and all of a sudden, boom, it exploded. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Trying to get some more flat fast blasts, but my computer's down all of a sudden, William, so we'll have to get that a little bit later on. And then, of course, we'll take phone calls with you next hour.
Yeah, but I mentioned that I'm having a conference here in Nashville in April. It's a physical immortality and light body conference on April 21st. It's going to be a two-day event. And I had a couple of these events here in Nashville last year. They were sold out, and we just had an absolute blast. And I limit participation to 40 people, and it's a really tremendous weekend. And this time it's going to be focused on the question, is physical immortality possible? And how do we begin to spend our lives in preparation for life in other dimensions?
Do you believe it is going to be possible, physical immortality? Keep changing body parts out?
But what is going to happen, I think, George, is that while we have the capability right now of utilizing genes, bits, neurons, and atoms, our four primary power tools, our genetic technology, our computer technology, our neuroscience, and our nanotechnology to affect this shift, what it's really going to take and what's coming online now is a spiritualization of the body. I think that what's going to happen is, and this isn't a criticism on Christianity per se, but I'll cite this as an example. For the past 1,500 years, we have focused on the cross and the death of Jesus as the primary symbol of Christianity. But there is another symbol, the resurrection, the transfiguration in which Jesus transforms into a being of light and enters a portal or a gateway. I think that what's going to happen is that we're going to start to shift away from images that promote suffering and misery and to images that promote rather ascension and transmutation or transfiguration. And what's going to happen is our whole culture is going to shift. I mean, as these discoveries from CERN come online, as many of the other discoveries come online here, our whole culture is going to shift so that it supports this idea of crossing between the worlds and the idea that we can live forever. I mean, right now, it's our culture that says, hey, for a male, you're 72 years and you're out of here, okay? It's our culture that kills us, not our genes. Our genes can go on a lot longer.
Yeah, but why is it? Why is it that mankind just doesn't let his mind explore to look into these areas that you've looked at? Why is it such a hateful being, a hateful entity?
Well, I think part of the answer, what I'm starting to really get a sense of, and this is Walter Cruttenden, wrote a book called Lost Star of Myth and Time,
right,
about our relationship with Sirius that really awakened me to this whole idea that a lot of what goes on this planet in terms of consciousness is mediated by forces outside of our solar system, that there are energies that come from other star systems. We're not talking astrology here. We're just talking plain old, we're talking just galactic methodology, so to speak, where we have a galactic center and a black hole, where we have energy emanating from the galactic center. Sirius appears to be one of the mediators of that energy, beaming enlightenment particles literally to this region of our solar system. And when we're in those, the wave, if you will, or in the vibe of these enlightenment particles, we awaken. When we're not in that vibe, we go into periods of darkness. And we're presently emerging from a period of darkness, entering into a zone or frequency of light.
I wonder if science will ever catch up with the things you've talked about tonight.
Well, they really are, but... You know, then what happens is when science start talking like this, suddenly other scientists say, oh, that's nothing but pseudoscience or that's religion. And so what always drops us or stops us in our tracks is ego, where you have one group that says, hey, I'm totally resistant to change, and I'm not open to new ideas. And that's the killer in almost every instance. And so what has to happen is we have to more and more let go of that ego and recognize that we're part of something absolutely astonishing and magnificent.
Well, it's like letting go of the past. It's the same thing. Just don't dwell on it.
Just don't dwell on it, right. And that is, in my opinion, more and more what I see, one of the primary life lessons that so many of us have on Earth is letting go. Letting go of the past, letting go of loved ones that move on and that sort of thing. It's really hard.
Let's go back to CERN for a moment. Do people who work on the project, are they, they take an oath, or what happens over there in England?
Actually, Switzerland, yeah, near
Switzerland.
Geneva. I don't know. An oath of secrecy, you mean?
Yeah.
Well,
there's so much information that's out there. And you say the tunnel goes between Switzerland and France?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Somebody's got to leak something.
Right. I mean, that's something I don't know about the kind of the hierarchy there. I mean, you have to imagine, I mean, you have scientists from 80 countries that are involved, a couple of thousand scientists. And so, yeah, the possibility that information will be leaked is certainly there. But you just wonder, are they actually going to release what they find, if there are findings? Because you have to imagine, and especially these days, that, if any kind of information can be used by terrorists, God forbid, then, you know, the whole thing's going to be locked down. And unfortunately, there are people that want to see us stay in kind of a dark place by keeping us terrorized, keeping us locked in to old modes of thinking, when in fact the universe is practically demanding that we let go and move forward.
Are these tests that they're going to be doing in November of 2007 on one little particle so minute you won't even be able to see it with the naked eye?
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, they're talking about their levels, you know, way, way beyond what we can physically see. And that's why they call it the Large Hadron Collider, because that's the name of the subatomic particle that they're going to shoot along these pathways. And so essentially what they're doing is trying to create a giant magnifying glass in a way so that we can actually see into these levels. And this is where now they're hoping that it's going to, one way or another, give us either proof of or against string theory, because we'll actually be able to work at such a high energy level that we'll be able to perceive these cosmic strings and see into these other dimensions that are presently invisible to us.
Well, as we know, Michio Kaku believes in the string theory. He's one of the founders of it.
It's going to be really interesting. I mean, it's going to change everything, and so it's like, wow, if things aren't exciting enough, it's about to get a whole lot more exciting.
You think they'll invite media, or is it going to be very closed?
No, I'm sure they're going to have a lot of media there. You can bet on that, but what actually is going to be revealed, it's probably, I think NASA is probably your best model for what they're going to actually be revealing, and what we're going to need is a Richard Hoagland out there needling them, digging into it, using extraordinary brain power to bring out the secrets.
You imagine if we had Richard Hoagland on one end and Alex Jones out there on another, squeezing everyone there.
Yeah.
They would never be able to get away. Couple more minutes, William, then we're going to open up the phone lines for you. Mythology, of course. The one thing I've never talked with you about is mythology of the Greeks, the Greek gods. Mm-hmm. One, ever look into it, and two, what do you think they were? Who were they?
Well, I'm in a very fortunate position here in Nashville. We have a scale replica, an exact replica, size-wise, of the Parthenon as it existed in ancient Athens.
In fact,
Nashville is called the Athens of the South, and there's some really strange stuff going on here in terms of similarities between modern Nashville and ancient Athens. And so I've had a great opportunity. I go to the Parthenon all the time. Inside, there's the tallest indoor statue in the Western world. It's a 42-foot-tall statue of Pallas Athena, the Greek goddess of wisdom and war. She's completely covered with 24-karat gold, just absolutely stunning. And so The Greeks were kind of a mystery to me until I realized that all the Greeks did is they learned all their stuff from Egypt and from Samaria. So once we can make the equation between the Greek gods and the Sumerian gods, in fact, the Anunnaki, it becomes pretty easy to navigate through Greek myth.
Well, they could all be one of the same, huh?
They're all based on the original Anunnaki stories, and so I always refer back to that, and it's worked for me very well so far.
All right, very good. William, once again, tell us where we can get the book, Skywalkers,
and
Star
the Dimension
Walkers
of the Blessed. Yes, at williamhenry.net or by calling 615-292-7863.
Toll free.
Actually, see, that's not a toll-free call.
No, but it's not.
If they call and leave a message, I'll be happy to return the call.
What the heck? What's a few cents when you get your book, huh? It's
right,
well
exactly.
Worth it. Well worth. Do you sign them?
I'll be happy to sign them if people request it. Some people
okay.
Will.
Stay with us. Phone calls next with you, William Henry, on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, William Henry, our guest, and your phone calls. Let's go to the calls. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Ratman from Hoagieland in Philly.
Ratman from Hoagieland, huh?
Ah, yes. It's a wonderful festival of food we have here. And on the shortest day of the year, there is more time for it.
Well, that's great. Now, what's on your mind, sir?
I like William Henry's thought processes really well. If he could describe for us what he thinks those Star Walkers would look upon our current petrochemical lifestyle as compared to their more high-energy origins.
I don't know. William, would they think anything like that?
Well, I don't know if they would, but I think they would look at this as sort of an alchemical cauldron, that what we're doing is trying to mix and match and transform what we have into a higher reality. I mean, and they would probably also have to assume that that's also what is holding us down is also what is ultimately going to be able to set us free. So I think there would be at least a couple of different levels of speculation on that.
Are these Star Walkers time travelers?
Well, kind of by definition, they are time travelers, yes. But they're most importantly, they're teachers, and that's kind of where we want to focus. They're instructors, and so the time travel question is certainly part of it. But if we use the analogy of like a professor coming to a college, we don't necessarily want to focus on their method of locomotion, how they get to the university. We want to focus on what it is they're teaching, and what they're teaching for us is how to activate these latent abilities within us.
Okay, next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. Welcome to the program. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
We are fine. William?
George, I wanted to I'm sorry to cut you off, William. George, I want to thank you for your program. I'm the rookie here, and so, of course, I've drawn the overnight shift, and I'm finding your show very entertaining.
I was on the overnights once, and I still am, so keep plugging.
That's right. It takes some getting used to. I've been chipping away at a work of fiction, and it has necessitated my researching and studying something that I was wondering if William had looked into, and that was he seems to know quite a bit about particles and whatnot. I was learning and became very fascinated with the notion of particle entanglement, and particularly with regards to teleportation. And I wondered if you'd ever looked into that. It sounds, if you haven't, I imagine it's something that you would find very interesting.
Yeah, I'm kind of on the edge of it, actually. I mean, it's funny to me, not funny, ha-ha, but very interesting that when you're reading the Bible and you read that the Israelites became entangled by the shores of the Red Sea, and you just wonder, well, what do you mean they became entangled? You know, do we interpret that word in light of its modern meaning? I mean, is it possible that the theory of entanglement was known in a way to the ancient world, and that they somehow knew that even though objects such as subatomic particles are apart from each other at far distances, that at a deeper level, they're all actually one? Did these ancient sages and mystics know this, and I think it's a very good possibility that they did.
There's something else that's another interesting aspect of that whole sort of science is that that they've discovered that when something is measured, it is necessarily then destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
When they the way they do it is they talk about mimicking particles. They have things called ancillary particles, and they have these particles mimic the particles that they're trying to transport. And as soon as they're measured at site A, they're destroyed. And what's interesting is that Einstein's theory is not broken, but bent, because knowledge that the object has actually been transported, the person has been transported, must follow the rules of light speed and all that sort of stuff in order to travel back from site B to site A, and so therefore the laws of physics are not broken. It's interesting stuff. I wondered if you'd looked into it.
Yeah, and again, I'm very fascinated by it, and we'll certainly be looking into it more. In fact, in my book Starwalkers and the Dimension of the Blessed, I symbolize the concept entanglement. The concept of entanglement with the rings, as in the entangled rings of Glastonbury Tor in England. And what's fascinating about this is that when they show these two rings merging or entangled, the field that forms in between the rings is a symbol called the Vesica Pisces, which is the mouth-shaped Egyptian hieroglyph for Ru, which means birth passage, doorway, or gateway. And the Egyptians called the field of the blessed the field of Aru, based upon this glyph and the notion that there was a doorway, a passage, or a gateway to the dimension of the blessed. And it appears that this idea of entanglement is all wrapped up in this whole concept.
What was that L.A. TV show that was much like time travel and portals? What was the name of that one?
It's
the Sliders.
Yeah.
Wasn't that it?
Yeah.
They would go through a portal to go to wherever they wanted to go, and they had a certain window in order to get to it before it closed up on them.
Yeah. One of the most amazing portal depictions, in my view, is in that masterpiece of a movie, What Dreams May Come.
I love that movie.
There's that scene where Robin Williams reunites with Cuba Gooding's character, and Cuba Gooding literally draws the Vesica Pisces, and it opens a door or gateway into an even more magical realm for Robin Williams. And I just love that scene. That whole movie is astonishing. And actually, it's a very good explication of the ancient Egyptian belief in the afterlife.
We're going to do a show one night, William, and just talk about some of these fascinating sci-fi type movies, paranormal type movies. I'd love to do that.
I mean, there's so much there, and I sometimes want to resist the tendency to write about them because, well, who wants to hear about a movie from 1996 like Contact? Well, you know, there's so much there, and this is how Jordan Maxwell, we mentioned him earlier. The movie theaters are, in a sense, the new temples. The gods are returning into these new temples of light, and we're recreating all the ancient myths and stories in movies.
Richard Hoagland is on a special system with me, and he wanted to thank you for mentioning him on your program.
Oh, anytime. Absolutely. Say hi to Richard for me. Hi, Richard.
Hello, Richard. He's out there listening. As a matter of fact, he's typing to me as I speak to you. Communications, William, absolutely stunning.
Beautiful.
I mean, here I am interviewing you worldwide, and Richard C. Hoagland camped in, sending me messages all night. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, hi. Welcome, and where are you calling me from?
I'm calling from Claremont, California.
All right, take it away.
And I had an experience a week ago that was the peak experience of my whole life. I was visited suddenly by a completely three-dimensional, glowing, vivid, lifelike, smiling figure of a very handsome young man that looked like what I vaguely remembered as my husband, because he died at 81 5 years ago with a full beard. This was a young, glowing, absolutely, it was so vivid I could hardly look at it. It was so beautiful. And I'm puzzling and puzzling And all of a sudden, he gets exasperated and says very loudly, "It's me!" And I was so flabbergasted. I said, "Oh, my God!" And he just smiled at me for a while and disappeared. What can I do if he ever does this again to keep him a little longer and try to get a conversation going? Or is there any hope of that? And how unusual is this? I think it's the most amazing thing that's ever happened to me. I never dreamed it would happen.
How do you close the portal door, William, once they come through?
I'm just so grateful. I've been praying and wondering and trying ever since he passed away to have this happen. And all of a sudden, he goes to great effort to reappear to me. I understand it's very difficult to do, and he did it for me. And I wasn't sure it could be really him. He was so young and so handsome.
It's the younger version. Well, can we keep him around, William? What do you do?
Yeah, that's a good question. I, to be perfectly honest, have
close
no
the
idea.
Portal. Close the portal. How do
well,
you do that?
Yeah, what I would say is, though, I would try and work with him on the dream level, because there is so much correspondence between our dream reality and the reality that the way people describe parallel dimensions. So perhaps you might have better success if you attempt to engage him on that level, as opposed to asking him to cross over into this reality, or in fact to try and keep him here.
Well, I was going to say keep him, because it sounds like he's already here.
Yeah.
East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us with William Henry. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah.
How are you tonight, this morning?
We are fine. Thank you. Go ahead.
Good. Concerning the spiritual of this phenomenon.
Turn your radio down. Sounds like it's confusing.
I'm out in the other room.
Okay.
I'll shut it off.
All right.
I've got some major surgery coming up in about 2 hours. I don't want to go into that. And my animals have been hanging around me, and they say that when they can sense when something's going to go wrong, and I'm terrified. I was in the Marine Corps through the 80s, and I've been scared quite a bit, but I've never been this terrified. And like that lady, the previous caller, I don't know if it was dreams or what, but I've seen my father who's gone. I've seen my grandmother who's gone. I've seen my mother who's gone. I think it was when I was asleep or half asleep. I'm terrified if something happens to me. How can I come back and contact? How do these portals work? Are we aware of it?
Well, we know more about the possibility of them and have the record that they actually exist, as opposed to the actual record of how they work. One of the primary things that I would encourage you, though, to meditate on as you in the coming hours, is make it your mantra to repeat the words, yes, love, and victory.
Yes, love, and victory.
Yeah, and get a clearer image in your mind of what is victory for you in this circumstance. If it's being able to leave a message or being able to return to your loved ones in this way, if that's your vision of victory, then get as clear a sense as you possibly can on as many levels as you can. In other words, feel what it would be like to experience that victory. Think about it. Try to smell it if you can. And engage all your senses to make this a bodily reality. I think that especially that signature word, love, that frequency or vibration of that word is what can help to carry you through this situation. But it's also focusing on that victory that will enable you to tune your consciousness to what you do want in this situation, and that's going to make a huge difference for you.
Okay, because, you know, the different religions say that there's purgatory and that there's a soul prison or what have you, and I'm concerned. But anyway, Mr. Norrie, great show. I listen to you every night.
Thanks, and good luck on your surgery, Ray.
Thank you very much. God bless.
All right. Well, I'll say a little prayer for you. You'll be okay. First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi. Where are you calling from?
Hi. Lebanon, New Jersey.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
My,
My name is Lucille, and I've been listening to you for a year, and I'm enjoying your programs immensely.
Thank you, Lucille.
Wonderful guest you have tonight, William. I would like to know if you would like to expand a little on the Galactic Center and the Star Sirius. Being into astrology myself, I don't know if you're familiar with any astrology lingo or anything. I know that Pluto is conjuncting the Galactic Center and it's going to hit twice. And, I mean, I have my own views on it, but I would like to hear others. So I'd be open to that.
Yeah, I'm not an astrologer. I've recently learned about this Pluto conjunction. And generally, what we learn from the ancients especially is that the Galactic Center is the place where our souls originated. And it's potentially also the place where our souls will return to. That doesn't mean it's the ultimate destination. It's envisioned as perhaps even a gateway into other realms, maybe even other galaxies. And so what we're told is that periodically our galactic center goes into an active phase where it's sending out high-energy cosmic rays. For reference, you might want to take a look at the works of Dr. Paul LaViolette. That's a very good place to bring some scientific data into your astrological forecasts. I know other astrologers that are beginning to work with the Galactic Center and are very appreciative of this kind of understanding about the Galactic Center. In fact, Dr. LaViolette, who is an astrophysicist, says that the tarot deck was designed by beings from outside of our solar system who had knowledge of the Galactic Center, and that the tarot cards are designed with that in mind and to, in fact, in a sense, align us with the galactic core.
Interesting. Well, you piqued my interest because you said that Sirius was going to be mediating. And I happen to be, interested in the star Sirius since I understand that is the portal to this universe. And ever since the vortex opened in April of 94, it's become stronger and stronger. And I know it's all about your own beliefs and what you feel in it for what would be manifested.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always nice to be open to what other people are feeling because, obviously, in a collective consciousness, we're all projecting outward.
Right. You might be interested. There was a mathematician. He died in 2000. His name was Dr. Charles Muses. And he also connected the energies of Sirius with some astonishing spiritual capabilities, and he thought that back in 1994 we entered into a flow of what he describes as energies or resonant energies from Sirius that have the possibility of sparking an evolutionary jump. So, and he says that this is most of the basis as well for the Egyptian mystery schools, that they were able to utilize these energies from Sirius to create these light bodies. So I write about this in Starwalkers and the Dimension of the Blessed, but perhaps one of your best sources on Sirius I mentioned earlier is Walter Cruttenden's book, Lost Star of Myth and Time. It's outstanding.
And the Dogon tribe, of course, I think had incredible information about Sirius long before telescopes had information.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Another valuable resource is Laird Scranton's work on the Dogon. He's got a book called The Science of the Dogon that's just out, and he's got some amazing insights about how these ancient sages had this advanced knowledge of Sirius and had direct knowledge of information that science is only rediscovering within the last 30, 40 years.
All right, stay with us. William Henry, our guest, will be back with him. We'll take more of your phone calls. I'm George Inori. This is Coast to Coast AM. Well, Mr. Henry, first of all, thank you for the simply delightful, inspiring night. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, George. It's been my pleasure, and I always love talking with you.
Me too. Me too. It's been a while. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello. How are you doing?
We're doing fine. Where are you calling from?
My name's Natalie, and I'm calling from New Orleans, Louisiana.
Oh, okay, Natalie. Go ahead.
I wanted to talk to you about the dream school and light bodies. Do you think it's possible for us to, as humans, like on this planet, to help the people that are here through schools, you know, like in the dream state, as far as like progression and working as light workers?
Yeah, I think so. And this, again, is coming from many of the mystery schools, including the Tibetans that I mentioned earlier. It seems that a very basic but also powerful place to begin working in this realm is in our dreams, to begin to, through our intention, through programming our dreams, to try to connect with our light body, to see our transparent bodies, and also to look for others that are in that state when we're in the dream state. Because, again, it appears that the, as we mentioned, the movie What Dreams May Come is a good example of the way the Egyptians thought of the afterlife state, where we spend, and this is why the Egyptians were so adamant about paying so close attention to your thoughts in this realm, because you're literally creating your life in the next realm. And so to the extent that you focus on purity and on transformation in this realm, you're going to be creating for yourself a platform upon which to exist in the next realm.
All right, West of the Rockies, you're on. Thanks for holding so long. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yeah.
Steve in Lower Lake, California.
Hi, Steve. Thank you.
I wanted to tell you that I can think of so many hilarious promotions where the punchline could be what you say in your fish oil commercial. Yep, I got my bottle. I hope you appreciate that. My question for William Henry, sir. I'm a dinosaur guy. I believe dinosaurs were the crown of creation. And on this little blue dot here, in this forgotten corner of this galaxy, we had a major catastrophe 65 or so million years ago. And I feel that if the dinosaurs had had even 4 or 5 more million years, they essentially were exterminated when they were at the level of the Miocene apes. The mammals still had all of their genetic potential because they were forced underground, basically, by the dinosaurs who were superior to them. And that's why we have what we call human beings on this particular planet. My question to you, William, is do you think that perhaps on other Earth-like planets throughout this galaxy and others, which undoubtedly exist, that creatures such as dinosaurs, which I know to be avian, not reptilian, do you think that they might be the technological, the top dog creatures, as opposed to the just the strange thing that happened here with the huge meteorite impact that eliminated the dinosaurs and allowed the mammals, which were essentially the B team, to evolve to what we are today? And I'll, unless you have a question, I'll hang up and listen on the air.
Gosh, yeah, I have no way of knowing. I mean, it sounds like an interesting possibility. I mean, we kind of want to project what happened on this planet onto all the other worlds that we are discovering. And so maybe it's possible, but I have no way of knowing.
Well, you realize that when the dinosaurs became extinct, that they didn't all become extinct.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that survived we call birds today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But at the time that the meteorite struck, there was a creature named Troodon who had binocular vision, a big central brain,
mm-hmm.
opposable thumbs, was bipedal. It hunted mammals. And imagine, just give it a few more million years and imagine what that could have become.
Mm-hmm. What do you think it could have become?
Well, it would have become essentially us.
Ah, okay. Interesting.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Go ahead, Steve. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Go.
Hi, this is Michael in Montana.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, long-time listener, off and on again over the years. I remember sitting out and doing guard duty and listening to Art, you know, on a shortwave. But here's the deal. I want to tell you guys about an experience I had with what I've been known to call, you might call it transportation. But I just, before I get into that, I just wanted to give a little insight into the Judaism religion. You talked about Jesus appeared to Mary Magdalene, and he said, "Don't touch me." Well, in ancient Judaism, when the high priest would go into the temple to cleanse the nation of Israel, he had to go through a rite of purification, and he couldn't let any unclean people touch him. And that is most likely what was going on there was he was going to go into his father's house, because it said he'll have zeal for his father's house. And he would go into his father's house, and he couldn't be touched by someone that wasn't without sin. And Mary Magdalene did have sin. Now, this is what's happened to me before. It's happened to me twice. I don't ever know when it's going to happen. I can tell when it's going to happen moments before it happens. But I've been transported from point A to point B in unbelievable amount of speed and time. But one time it was in a car, and the other time was on a backpacking trip with another individual. When I was in the car, I felt this tingling sensation that it's very hard to describe. It was very electrical, but not painful or anything like that. And I was going the speed limit, and I covered what was about 300 miles in about 20 minutes. I didn't feel like I was going super fast. I periodically would look for landmarks. They wouldn't be there. I'd go through the horizon. I'd see the mountain range, and it'd be 100 miles behind me when it should have been just right by my side. The second time was on a backpacking trip. I actually saw what was like a glittering spider web between some trees, and the person that was walking with me was having some very difficult time with their backpack. They actually had a nervous condition that was genetic, and they felt like it was coming on, and they would have to rest for a day. And when I saw that, I told him, I said, "You see that ahead of you?" And he goes, "Yeah." And we walked through it, and his disease subsided, and we again were transported probably about 15 miles in a matter of 10 minutes.
All right, thanks. I appreciate you being part of the program. Go ahead, Steve, call up our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
My question actually is about the lost civilization that I've heard rumors about that are, I'm not sure if they are still living under there today, but I've heard that they were living underneath the ground we are on right now. I was wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, yeah, there's all kinds of interesting research that's being done on a race that lives in the inner Earth and this sort of thing. You know, I'm not really sure where I'm at with this whole subterranean worlds idea. It's really interesting. It's very perplexing, too, and I think there's a lot there. I just haven't really fully explored it, so don't have a whole lot more to say about that. But you might want to take a look at some of the Rosicrucian material on this idea. There was the book called The Coming Race by Bulwer Lytton that talked about this advanced subterranean race that possessed this substance they called Vril power. The danger here is that, of course, you know, the Nazis got a hold of this type of information and ran it all the way to Auschwitz, and 50 million people died as a result of it because of the misuse of these kinds of concepts and the belief in a master race that dwells in the inner Earth and this whole sort of thing. So, yeah, it's very interesting to research, but kind of strange too.
Okay, let's go east to the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Frank, I appreciate your show. I used to listen to Art Bell. My name is Valerie. I'm from a little mountain town called Peekskill, New York, but I'm in Little Rock right now. My mother passed away in 2003, and a year later, I was reading a book about this French lady, a true story. She had a pathological closeness to her daughter. I felt like my mother had the same thing. And my mother was sort of like a Florence Nightingale. She was an RN at the VA for 38 years. And she never remarried, and she was like a saint. And she was like joined at the hip of her mother, took care of everybody that got sick in the neighborhood. And I feel like she's trying. A year later, I got sick, And I landed in a wheelchair, and I feel like she's trying to pull me to her light. And when I had the surgery, before I had the surgery on my back, I saw a light, a big ball of light go real slow and gentle down, like on an angle in my window, and I felt this sensation that I'll be okay. And then 5 minutes later, her best friend in the whole world called me from New Jersey and said she heard that I was in the hospital. And when they cross over, do they, if they're very close to you on Earth, do they try to pull you to them? And the other question is, what do you think about the Ezekiel and the lights and the spaceships and the Bible codes? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, this goes back to this whole idea of entanglement that we talked about with the gentleman earlier, that two things, although they appear separate, can still be in communication with one another, in fact, entangled. And that the whole idea here is that we all create a bioinformational field while we're in this realm, on this planet. And so it's possible that while this person could be in another field, that they could still be communicating with us in this realm right here. So that kind of answers that. And as to Ezekiel is another classic example of a star walker, of a being who affected this bodily ascension and became a star walker. That the gentleman who mentioned the Ark of the Covenant a moment ago also brought up an important thought as concerns this, because of course Ezekiel was one of the prophets that was brought to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar, and it's thought that the Ark of the Covenant was present at that time and that Nebuchadnezzar was trying to make the Ark of the Covenant work. Well, some people believe that the Ark also generated a field, a frequency field. And in fact, when you look at the depictions that I have on the coast site of the gate to the dimension of the blessed, we see gods entering or exiting this realm through a field, as it's described, that's produced by two pillars. Well, these could be the analogous to the two cherubim on the Ark of the Covenant that create this field that opens the gate that enables these beings to go, come and go to, through an open doorway or portal from this realm to another realm.
These portals, how big are they in terms of width? Are they small or huge?
I think that we're really talking about the very tiny level, the nano level, George. It seems that...
Really? Okay.
Yeah, that we're talking extremely small levels here.
Okay, next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, it's Nina from Burlingame.
Hi, Nina.
And I'm wondering if your guest can answer a question for me.
He'll do the best he can.
Okay. The mythology and the symbology surrounding the white owl with the ancient Egyptians and the Greeks.
So it's the owl of Minerva, like the one up on the right-hand corner of the dollar bill. The symbol of wisdom, also the symbol of the goddess as well.
Right, and what does it actually mean if a white owl keeps following you, and it actually appears to you?
Gosh, I don't know. That's a good question. If you email me at WilliamHenry@WilliamHenry.net, I'll be happy to hit the books and see if I can come up with something for you.
That is kind of fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Go next to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My name is Rainbow Starwalker.
Your name is Rainbow Starwalker. Oh, very nice. Good name for tonight.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I wish you a happy holidays, and William Henry also.
Thank you.
And I would like to say that we have a website called www.dowsing.com. And I know you have an interest in dowsing, and you're also in the Missouri area, so we'd like to meet with you sometime. We listen to the live stream of Coast to Coast on paltalk.com,
mm-hmm.
and I also admin in our spirit guides on paltalk.com.
Well, why don't you send me an email, Rainbow, and let me know how we can get a hold of you. I'm going to be here for about a week and a half.
Okay, I will do that.
Any questions for William while you have us?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
As a Starwalker, I do astral travel myself, and I am given and shown various insights and awareness on higher subconscious levels of understanding. I embrace what is given. When I am in this world and I give this, my question is, I do not understand why, when you are given what is needed in the spirit, from spirit, with the same spirit of love, why that this is not a reality. It's almost as if people do not want the reality from beyond this world. The focus and the mindset and the conscious...
we're going to run out of time here, Rainbow.
Imprinting is only in this world. So if it isn't a focus in this world, then it isn't real to someone.
And you're right. And that's what I was saying earlier, that this is one of the profound shifts that's happening, as our culture is beginning to support the idea of crossing between the worlds and the idea of Starwalkers. And it's movies, especially like Contact, Stargate, we've mentioned the TV show Sliders, other examples of myth-making in the modern world that are showing to us this possibility, and now it's becoming more and more supported by our culture that this is possible. So we're going to see some rapid advancements in this area, I believe, in the next 5 to 7 years as we run up to 2012.
It could make airplanes obsolete if they're successful in doing something like this.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the anticipated outgrowths of what's going on at CERN, is new propulsion systems, clean energy systems, all kinds of novel technologies such as that.
William, keep in touch, my friend.
Thank you, George.
William Henry, WilliamHenry.net is his website. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.